Hello! For what is the final time in book two of Alexander Quick and, I guess, the Alexander Quick series, I guess is what I'm saying. The final time in book two of the Alexander Quick series. But welcome back to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name's Brady, and with me, as always, are my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert. And it's finale week.
Woo! More like finale 2 weeks, because we suck, but...
No, that's okay.
It's certainly finale week, which is exciting because we've reached the end of yet another Alexander Quick book, this time in about half of the time as it took us to get through the first one, which feels good, and also it means that there's a break on the horizon.
A nice, long break.
We've been, we've really just grinded this sucker out. I mean, I know that we missed a couple of weeks here and there, but for the most part, we put out something like 50 episodes in 54 weeks or something like that. Yeah. So it's been a big task this year working through these two books as regularly as we have been.
It's like a low A, high B on consistency.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like mentally, it'll be nice to have the break, I think. Because, I mean, every week, you know, we were constantly messaging each other, asking when we could record, you know, especially this season. I mean, it's been more difficult than the first season, for sure. It doesn't help that I decided to move 3 hours away, but... it'll be a good break, and but it's also been a great season. I think it's similarly with the Alex Quick series. The second book and our second season was much better than the first.
That is true. I kind of blame you, Baylor, because really the monotony of just having to stare at no one but Brady the whole time I'm in here has really just ruined the experience.
I mean, I don't look at anything. I look at a wall.
Yeah. I mean, some would take that over Brady.
Most people, I would say. Most people would take that over looking at me for what is, I have no idea how many hours, probably
a
close
lot.
To 80 hours of content at this point. And
yeah.
It's been a good book. This book is certainly better than the first book. I think we can all agree on that. There's quite a bit more that happens. So it'll be fun to give this book a nice send-off. And if you listen to our season one, our book one finale, this one's going to be largely the same, except we're not going to have a special interview for this one. Just getting it scheduled for us to sit down and record these episodes the last couple of months has been so difficult that we figured tossing another person into the mix would have made that even more difficult to make happen. So we're not going to have an interview this episode, but we are going to go through and do a few things, talk about different parts of the book. We're each going to come up with our own summaries of the book. We are bringing back the 3-sentence summary for this episode. We're going to go through who we think the top 7 characters are, as well as some honorable mentions. And then we'll finish off the season with Baylor making one final prediction for book 3 and the things he thinks might happen in book 3. So it is going to be an action-packed episode. Double down by the fact that we have a very limited time in the studio tonight to finish this episode.
True. Someone was busy spending too much time on their project to let us in on time.
Right, we got in late. We were scheduled to record this last night and had to move it because I had to make an emergency trip to a neighboring town about an hour away last night to drop off some stuff. It's been hectic, so we're going to keep that theme up by making this episode pretty hectic as well, I think.
Excellent. I'll try to stay on topic, kind of.
But yeah, we read Alexander Quick in the Lands Below. We read it good and we read it hard.
We did.
I guess we could just maybe open with our general thoughts of the book, kind of overall.
I was going to open with something else.
Sure, whatever.
Just to go off topic and waste
time. Let's just jump off the rails immediately.
Exactly. We do have two comments. One of them I think you have seen. The other one you have not. They're both from authors.
Oh, cool.
The first is Inverarity in the Discord. Author of the fan fiction we're currently reading. Basically said, hey, congrats on getting to the second episode. And then also gave a good deep dive on Abraham Thorne, which I'm not going to read here because it's in the Discord for one, and two, it has spoilers and Baylor's on, of course. So we don't want to talk about what happens in later books. If you want to check out the author's thoughts, go to the Discord. Second person, Leo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sent us a message, said congratulations on getting through the second book.
Huh.
Sent it on Reddit, I believe, so that's why you guys weren't aware.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That is nice to hear from our good friend Leo, one of the people we interviewed earlier this season, actually, about one of their fan fictions, and that was one of my favorite episodes we recorded the whole season.
Great episode. Bagsy Beetlehorn and the Thorned Gauntlet, I believe?
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
Yep. It was also a great book.
I still haven't made it to book two because I've been busy with this. But maybe during our break, I'll try to binge that series as well.
I actually was planning on binging a couple fan fictions this winter.
Ooh, nice.
Ooh, yeah. Which ones?
Alexander Quick, number 3, 4, and 5, actually.
Oh.
No. No, I was thinking the second book in the Bagsy Beetlehorn series, also checking out the Artificer. And I also was getting some stuff ready for next season for Alexander Quick and the Deathly Regiment, I believe. And I noticed that it's, this might be a spoiler, I don't know, you guys can tell me if I shouldn't do this, but it's set around the same time period as a book based in Hogwarts. I can't remember the name. That's kind of dumb of me now. I will find
out. The Cursed Child?
No. Sorry.
Definitely. A book based on Hogwarts. Hogwarts, Deathly, a history.
Deathly Regiment's like, what, 2008?
No, it's another fan fiction.
Oh, I see.
Oh.
Gotcha.
Hogwarts House Divided?
Yes.
That's the other one by Inverarity,
isn't
it?
That's by Inverarity.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So, read it if you want to. There's no connection to Alex Quick whatsoever. So, you're not going to spoil yourself at all.
Okay.
It's fine. I mean, it's his first, as far as I remember, it's Inverarity's first fan fiction, or at least big foray into fan fiction. And it's not my favorite, to be honest. I didn't really enjoy it that much, but you should check it out if for anything else, just to check out the other kind of stuff that Inverarity has been writing. However long ago it was. I don't even know when he wrote Hogwarts House Divided.
Yeah.
Alex Quick is much older than you realize. I think the first book came out in 2007.
Oh, I thought it was even before that, to be honest. So.
It says Hogwarts House Divided was released December of 2007 as well. So,
oh, okay. So maybe both around the same time.
Around the same time as the first book of the Alex Quick series.
Yeah. I was actually considering diving into the fanfic of the fanfic, which I believe is called Alexander Quick and the Order of the Phoenix.
Something like that, yeah.
I forget who wrote it, but it's obviously a fanfiction of a fanfiction, so that's unique, I guess.
I probably will not be diving into any extra fan fiction going forward. I'm going to try to read some original novels in the next couple of months.
Oh, my other project is to read the entire list of Stephen King novels, which that's going to take a while.
That sounds interesting. I've never read a single one of his books.
So. It might take like 2+ years, but I know some of the movies based off his books I love, and some of the movies based off his books I hate, so...
Perfect.
Time to actually read them for once.
So that'll be seen on our next podcast titled Books We've Never Read That Are Scary.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Right. A Stephen King chapter by chapter podcast.
Right.
For sure.
Stephen King, but every time the word king appears, that's the end of the episode.
What?
Yeah.
Dude. Anyways, it's been... It's been nice to have people reach out to us back to the topic that got us off topic throughout the season. It's been especially nice having Inverarity pop in every so often and give us some special author's insight to kind of flesh out some of the things, some of the ideas we've been missing. It's been a real positive of this season so far.
Yeah, I definitely have enjoyed the interaction he's given us. He's kind of, it seems like he's listening in batches of episodes, which is completely fine. But I just, you know, once again, find it fascinating how he's able to explain something but not give his opinion on it at the same time. You know what I mean? So he's always giving the reader something to wonder about, even when it's coming out of his own mouth.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that that's a really nice way to put it, is that he gives a lot of information without dictating how you feel or think about that information. And that's positive for discourse, I think, overall surrounding the story. I bet it's easier with something like a fan fiction because you're not making money off of it. So you're not so hard pressed to influence people's opinions in a positive manner. You can sort of just let them think about it because you're not going to have your income reduced by negative reviews and stuff like that.
Yeah, I also really do respect Inverarity because he takes the punches along with the nods towards loving stuff. Like, there's people that talk about it. We've talked about stuff we don't like in parts of the books and stuff. I mean, you even just said Hogwarts House Divided, not your favorite thing. But he doesn't take it personally. It's awesome. Yeah, I love to see that.
I would say overall the Discord is a positive place to interact with Inverarity and other people in general. There's been some really interesting discussions going on there of late. So again, I would push you towards the Discord if somehow you're listening to this and you're not already in there.
There is a link in our description.
There is. With that being said, there's one little touch of Harry Potter news. The voice of the Sorting Hat passed away.
I saw that.
And so that's unfortunate, but Leslie Jordan is the voice actor's name, and I have to tell you, the Sorting Hat is such a cool character, and so the fact that this person brought it to life so well, and did so well is pretty nice.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie, like I never thought that there was a person behind the Sorting Hat, and maybe that says, you know, it calls to their excellence in the acting, is that it made the Sorting Hat come to life, and so I thought of the Sorting Hat as the Sorting Hat, and it's not like, it's something I never really thought about. It's not like Hagrid, you know, like I think about Hagrid, I guess, more than most actors, or more than most characters, sure. I guess, in Harry Potter. The Sorting Hat, it's like, yeah, it's the Sorting Hat. But then when it shows up in the show and it, you know, sings a song or does something like that, like it sets the stage basically for the movie. And so definitely played a very important part. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I also had a horrible misspeak, and it's not Leslie Jordan who played the Sorting Hat and recently passed away. It's Leslie Phillips who played the Sorting Hat and recently passed away. But Leslie Jordan did also recently pass away, which was a tragedy all in its own right, because Leslie Jordan was making some absolutely hilarious TikToks that I was really enjoying during the pandemic. So one way or the other, two Leslies have passed away, one Harry Potter related, one not. Both sad in any instance, and it's just another person we can add to the kind of ever-growing list of Harry Potter related actors who are slowly passing away now as time moves forward and claims its birthright.
That's really tragic. I just found out that Leslie Jordan passed away because of this.
Well, now you know.
Yeah, yeah. Sad.
At any rate, we do have some important discussion to get to. And again, I would like to open the floor to just general thoughts about this book. Baylor, I know you had suggested that you've got some things you want to complain about as well. So I think we should take a little bit of time here to work our way through some of that. So, general thoughts about the book. I want to start off by saying that this is a massive improvement over book number one, I think, in terms of story and in character development.
I agree. And that's not to say that the first book was bad. It just, this one was constantly moving forward, whereas in the first book, you felt like you were stuck in the same place for, what was it, 10 or 15 chapters. And part of that was probably because, you know, we were doing chapter by chapter, so it never built up steam for me, whereas like this, I could kind of get in a groove with a couple chapters at a time. But still, definitely this book flowed better, it felt better, the story progressed better. So yeah, I completely agree.
Here's my take on this stuff. When we asked what our favorite books were at the beginning, Brady, this was mine. Lands Below out of the five. But also, I love the first book. Because when I started reading fan fiction, I was kind of skeptical. I got pulled in with the fan service from Nightmares of Futures Past. I've already talked about that plenty of times. But to be able to pick up something that I'd never really read before, never really read a full fleshed out fan fiction like this, and them do world building just as good as it was in Sorcerer's Stone with the Goblin Market was amazing. So, I'm a big fan of that. I also don't know how much I've shared about this with the audience, but when I first picked up this series, it was during COVID. I was partially homeless at the time, and I was working like 12-hour days in DoorDash because I spent all my time in my car. And specifically in this book, the chapter that Max died, I think you kind of saw it coming, Brady, but I did not. And I remember sitting in a parking lot in Simi Valley, California, just sobbing in my car. Like, Max was such a great character, and it was such a great buildup, and I loved it so much that I think I've said this part. As soon as he was taken away, I was all in. I was ready to finish the entire series right then. So I think they're both great books in their own way, but even though I like this story better, and even though I think this one's written better, it's hard to take away the world building from the first one.
I think that's an incredibly apt way to describe these two books, and that we're certainly not saying the first book is worse, like just in general is a worse book. This book is just better, I think, for the writing. And again, like I said, the character development. A big part of the reason why I like this book more than book number one is because Alex becomes a person in this book, not just an antagonizing, annoying little girl, right? I think if Alex had continued in this book the way that she was for much of book number one, it would have been a very difficult sell for me to continue on with this series, right? Book number one, I continued on in spite of itself because I wanted to see what the conclusion was. Book number two, I read because I liked the people I was reading about. Max and Alex's relationship is incredible. Learning more about Max's mom and sister, Miss King and Julia, and how they're going to play a part in Alex's life was a really gratifying experience, because to this point, we've only seen Alex really have close relationships with Anna and then her other friends at Charmbridge, but those are not really that deep, right? They're not really deep relationships with Max, with Miss King, with Julia. We get some much deeper relationships than we did in the first book. And so that, I think that allows the reader to dive more headfirst into the story, right? You're not reading it in such a guarded fashion because there's people that actually care about the protagonist, and the protagonist is somebody who you can actually care about as the reader. So the first book is great. You're absolutely correct, Delbert. For me, the second book is better because I just feel like the people in the second book, including Alex, are better.
I mean, you look at every series, like every popular series, the first book, the first movie, whatever it is, in my opinion, is typically more boring than the rest of the series. I mean, you look at like Fellowship of the Ring for Lord of the Rings. That was an incredibly slow movie. Like there was maybe one or two fight scenes in that entire movie. You know, whereas like Return of the King, or, you know, like there's tons of fighting, there's tons of war, you know. Or you look at, I mean, even like Harry Potter, the first book. When I reread the series, I honestly dread that those first like four chapters, because I just they're so like boring in my opinion. Just like hearing, you know, how Harry is dropped off, the Dursleys' upbringing, all this garbage, you know. That's just my personal opinion. And so I knew coming in that the first book was going to be something like that. I mean, he has to create a world. He has to create this American wizarding world, you know. And especially from his point of view, where he's trying to fledge out all this diversity and you know, racism, basically, and all these other issues that exist in actual society, which, in my opinion, J.K. Rowling really kind of just went, you know, flew over without even bothering to mention or anything. So, obviously, the first book is very important. But, I mean, you brought up the death scene of Max. Out of every book that I've ever read, I think that scene might be the most powerful scene of someone dying that I've ever read. And the only exception, I think, is The Fault in Our Stars, because, I mean, who doesn't tear up in that scene? But, like, honestly, from her fan fiction to do that to me was incredibly moving. And that's why this book swayed over the first book, if that makes sense.
I agree with you. And I actually also want to share, too, I agree the death scene was, like, perfect, because you, like, slowly feel more and more helpless and realizing you can't do anything about it through Alex's eyes. And rather than Fault in Our Stars, which, great book, by the way, I actually equate this more to Bridge to Terabithia, which was a book that also made me cry when one of the main characters died. So, yeah.
I just think, like, if this was the normal Harry Potter series, and I think I caught myself in this when I was reading this scene, like, I would have expected everyone to survive, all of the good guys to survive. You know, like, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, they always survived. And yes, there was, like, some tension, but I never thought, oh, Hermione's going to die or Ron's going to die. You know what I mean? But in, like, this right, scene, I mean, I was thinking that. And then, like you said, that there's this buildup, and then you realize, like, one of them's going to die. Like, it's out of their control, you know what I mean? So, like, it was great writing.
In the original series, it takes until book 4 for someone to die. They even go back with time travel and fix it in book 3 of killing an animal. So you're right. It's like a totally different series.
It's a very strong moment when Max dies, and we've talked about that quite a lot moving forward. And I think there's just so much good to talk about with this book that we've had plenty of discussion on throughout our chapter discussions, throughout our arc discussions, getting to this point. And I would just say that as an overall piece of literature that you're going to read, this book stands out much stronger than the first book does. Because of the stuff you guys are talking about with Max's death, but also because of the very complicated relationship that we see developing between Alex and her father as well. And also the kind of towing the line, kind of limboing around friendship stuff that Alex does with everybody at school, where it's very clear that there is a distinct line between Alex and even her closest friends and Anna and the Ozarker twins. So the fact that those things are so easily established throughout this book and then maintained, there's not an easy solution to any of the problems in this story. There is no plot armor going into effect to protect Alex or anybody else, aside from the fact that Alex is the main protagonist in a long series of books, is a pretty impressive feat. And that's to say nothing of the entire subplot that we have throughout the book of what's going on with the Mors Mortis Society. How are these young wizards getting in contact with dark wizards and witches? What's going on with Darla Dearborn, right? There's tons of things going on in this book that all lead to an ultimate conclusion or an ultimate finale of the book where Max dies and Alex has to escape from this unbeknown realm of horrible creatures and very strange things. And it makes sense the whole time, right? There is no point in this book where you go, now, how did we get from there to here?
You're right.
Right. How did we get from this happening in the basement to now Max is dead? There is none of that, because you can very easily track everything that's happening and how it's leading to that moment.
Yeah. And another thing, too, with the tone in the original series, Harry Potter, we all know who the good guys and bad guys are. Harry is the hero. We know that right away. When he takes the stone, Dumbledore destroys it, so clearly he's a good guy as well. There's never any doubt. But right now, where we stand, Alex has just basically sacrificed her brother to further her terrorist father's plans. So we don't even know where we are on the good chart as far as Alex goes.
We don't. We didn't even know where Max was for like the first 60% of this book on the good chart, right? We don't know what Diana Grimm's intentions are. We don't know what Lilith Grimm's true intentions are. We have no idea what's going on with Alex's parents and why they don't seem to care about anything. So it's like, it's so in depth and there's so much complicated stuff happening that you can see why this is a series of books rather than just one book standing alone. But it's not that it has to be a series because the writer has made things so confusing. It has to be a series because there's just so many intriguing plot lines that need to be followed through and carried out. Now, Baylor, you said that you have some things that you do want to complain about, so I would love to hear some of those before we kind of start moving through our little agenda that we have here.
Well, I think the best course of action right now, since we have limited time, most of the stuff that I was going to talk about is in, we can talk about when I talk about the least favorite part of my book or least favorite part of this book. So if you want, we can talk about it then, or we can talk about it now.
Let's do that right now. Why don't we just all talk about our least favorite parts of this book right now?
So I guess I'll go ahead and start. I mean, honestly, my least favorite part of this book is every interaction that Alex or Max has with Abraham Thorne. And the reason I say this, and it's kind of along the lines of what you just said, Brady, is that we don't know really anything about Abraham Thorne. And not only that, but the character himself, Alex has asked, never saw Max ask anything, but Alex asks, and we just don't get any answers. Every time he makes an appearance, we learn nothing of the Thorn Circle. We learn nothing of their plans. We learn nothing of why he hates the Confederation. We learn nothing of how the Thorn Circle had their downfall that they had. And honestly, it's incredibly frustrating to me because, yes, last episode we covered the anti-Thorn sentiment of the podcast, but my goodness, unless you've read all the books and something crazy happens, if you're where I'm at, you're reading this for the first time, how are you pro-Thorn at this moment? Because literally he just stands there and says nothing and says all these elegant words to say nothing. So that's my least favorite part of the book.
Yeah, Nick from New Jersey.
yeah, Abraham Thorne's interactions with Alex are incredibly complicated because you're exactly right, where he's a politician and he tries to be a politician even to his own daughter. You know, she very clearly has some questions about what are his intentions and why is he doing some of the things he's doing? What are his motivations? And he very skillfully, I would say, even though Alex is very adept at calling him out on his BS, but very skillfully dances around those questions and leaves both her and the reader with typically more questions or certainly more outrage than they had before the conversation takes place.
Yeah, especially, I mean, it's especially difficult for me because I can't go and read the third book tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like, unfortunately, I have to wait until season 3 of the Remedial Magic podcast to read the next book. So I think in a normal story where I'm like, oh, I'm done with this book, I'll move on to the next book, I probably wouldn't feel this way. But right now, man, I'm pissed.
Something that I dearly love about this podcast is that we, by the nature of the podcast, get to talk about things as they're happening now without considering anything that might happen going forward. And that makes it a lot of fun because we get to have a lot of happiness and outrage about stuff that will probably get turned on its head sometime in the future.
Right.
Yeah. Delbert, what's your least favorite part of this book?
So, first off, I'd like to preface this with I agree with you, Brady, when you talk about how much a lot of our characters have progressed in their building. Like, Alex has become a much better person, or much more likable person at the very least. But we also have a lot of character regression in this book, which might be my least favorite part. Anna Chu goes from being this, like, very strong, like, pillar of support for Alex to being, at least for a part of the book, a racist little girl who is kind of awful. And that sucked to see. And, I mean, by the end of it, Alex is, you know, kind of made her and Tomo make up. But you also have some other characters like Larry Albo. Nothing happened, even though he was so important in the first book or such a prominent figure in the first book. I don't even think the Rash twins are mentioned. And then Dean Grimm is also missing in action until the very end of the book, basically. So a lot of characters, and this is how it's going to happen in a book, that you can't focus on everyone at once. But a lot of characters didn't get the spotlight or didn't improve, and some of them got worse.
When you say some of them got worse, specifically regarding Anna Chu, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
She did get worse.
She did.
If you look at it from her perspective, I think it's fair. Like, at some point, if you're Alex's friend, you're probably not going to really be on board with the things she does anymore. But from Alex's perspective, Anna just became, like, kind of a whiny person.
Especially in the beginning, when she has some racist stuff going on with Tomo, gets punished for it, and then complains every single day in J-Rock that she doesn't want to be in J-Rock, even though Alex is there because of her.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not only that, but Alex also found someone better, you know, in her opinion, which is a brother.
Right.
And so...
Also, to be fair, not unreasonable for a 12-year-old.
No.
No.
I think it makes sense.
Not unreasonable for a person of any age, to be honest.
Yeah.
If you right now, Delbert, found out you had a long-lost brother or sister, and you started spending more time with them than you do with us, I would like to think I would understand.
Right.
I get that Anna's 12, so whatever, but I would like to think that me, as a 29-year-old adult, would understand that you, a 28-year-old adult, wants to spend more time with this all of a sudden brand new family member that they just realized they had. And Alex has basically nobody, right? She does have her friends, but in terms of family, she basically has nobody that cares to talk to her.
Yeah.
So her want to spend more time with Max is justified and understandable.
Yep.
Yep.
My least favorite part of this book, this is a bit different than you guys in the way, the direction you took this, but my least favorite part of this book is that we don't get more of the Mors Mortis Society.
Okay.
That's fine.
I'm very happy that Alex stepped out, right? That's like one of the only times where she's made a choice that's totally subverted all of our expectations, which is really fun. But I would like to have seen more of the Mors Mortis Society because they were doing some very interesting stuff, and Inverarity is writing about magic that we don't ever hear or see about, really, in the main series, aside from the use of Crucio. And I would have liked to have seen more of that, more creative magic interpretation from Inverarity about what's happening at these Mors Mortis Society meetings.
I almost said my least favorite thing was wanting more, but that was too generic, so I like that you specified Mors Mortis.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of unanswered questions, but that's why there's still five more books.
Yeah, there is. And I do hope we get more Mors Mortis Society going forward. But I guess they were all expelled.
They're all expelled.
So, yeah. anyways, though, like, I just thought the Mors Mortis stuff was very interesting. It would have been cool to see what Max was doing in those meetings, even as like a sidebar conversation, if he's really fully participating to play the part, or if he's just hanging back and observing, or who knows what's going on. So it would have been fun to see more of that.
I agree. Yeah. I'm always fascinated by the magic side of things. So I'm definitely right there with you.
I guess we can follow up our least favorite parts of the book with our most favorite parts of the book. If you guys are prepared for that.
I am,
if you'd like me to go.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm going to sound like a broken record. In fact, I'm echoing your sentiment as well from a lot of book one talk. Finding out more about the world. Like, you talked about it earlier, going to Croatoa and meeting the kings and seeing how they live on a magical horse ranch. Getting to hear more about the Japanese versus Chinese wizarding feud that's going on. Getting to see all these magics that come from seemingly Native American origins with John Manuel Ito. It's just cool to see. It's very fun, very cool.
It's a very unique perspective that this book gives us. Like, because it is America, it is kind of the blending of cultures, you know? So you see a lot of that different stuff, so I completely agree.
It's a legitimately better expansion of the Wizarding World than what we've gotten from JKR since the end of the main series. A very legitimately better expansion. And so even if it's not official, it doesn't matter to me because there's so much stuff being explained that wouldn't be explained otherwise.
You're right. And in fact, just a brief touch on it. Fantastic Beasts, isn't it frustrating that Newt's traveling to all these different places and all of the spells are the same? Everyone's using Hogwarts Book of Spells.
New World Magic. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be cool if when he went to Indonesia, or I believe that's where he was, if you saw some sort of weird ritual magic that would be more akin to like the tribal people that lived there for thousands of years.
Wouldn't it be nice to just include some history?
Right.
Right. Again, they're movies versus books, so the amount of information you can include is limited, but that doesn't. It doesn't excuse the fact that you're exactly right. JKR's Wizarding World is one blanket set of rules applied to different settings, right? Whereas what Inverarity's done is taken a different setting and given it its own culture and its own pop, you know? So I agree with what you're saying. Learning more about the Wizarding World, and I'll expand or maybe get more specific than you because mine's in the same vein. My favorite part of this book was exploring the lands below.
Yeah.
Right?
It's cool.
The Lands Below is a cool place, and I had a hard time not saying my least favorite part was not getting more of the Lands Below. You know, it's a cool place, and it's also so different than what we're getting at Charmbridge or what we've seen at Hogwarts with all these different fantastic beasts and different cultures and societies. It's legitimately a place, as I've said on this podcast and told you many times, that I think you could set an adventure game or a D&D campaign and have a lot of success because of how different and unique it is.
That's kind of along the same lines that you said. Like, it's probably not something that if it ever was mentioned in the original series, it wouldn't have been explained. And so for Inverarity, basically to not only build on book one's interpretation of the Confederation and the United States, but also to introduce this new world in the same book and do it as good as he did. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And yeah, just like you said, I mean, seems like a fascinating place. Like almost things are almost turned upside down compared to the lands above.
Well, and how cool is it that we get a Harry Potter Wizarding World style book where the final conflict doesn't take place at school?
Right. Well, it's kind of at school.
It's kind of at school, but it's really not. It's in a totally different location, right? And that's nice because the world is bigger than Charmbridge. The world is bigger than Hogwarts. So expecting every big conflict to culminate in the school setting just because the children are school-aged is unrealistic, even in a book as unrealistic as a book about the Wizarding World.
Right.
Yeah. I would love to see what got cut on the writing room floor, I guess, in this case, from Inverarity that could have also been included in the Lands Below, because the stuff that was included, Bui and the Lagaru, the Underwater Panthers, the Generous Ones, even Quimli being like this kind of half above world, half below world house elf that's free, all interesting aspects of that place. Oh, even the corn children, too, that are, like, super excited for the sun and ask Alex to bring their father, the sun, to them. Like, it's such bizarre stuff, but it's all really, really cool.
Very neat stuff. Absolutely.
Yep.
Baylor, what was your favorite part of this book?
So I kind of went down a different road. It's kind of similar to what you said earlier, how we see Alex become a person. And so my favorite part was when Alex went to Croatoa for Easter break, because that's kind of the first time that we've seen her genuinely happy. And going back to the first book, it never really seemed like Alex was in a place that she belonged. Even though she had these friends at Charmbridge, you know, she has her parents, obviously, but we learned in this book that her parents don't really, or at least her mom doesn't even want to know what's going on at school. Just her going to Croatoa, being around other witches and wizards, being around Miss King and Julia, and just being welcomed by them. I mean, it's like kind of an explosion of Alex's character, of more of the brighter side. You know what I mean? So that was my favorite part of this book.
I like it. I think it's very close, maybe even more important than Harry's first time at the Burrow. Like, it's finally getting away from somewhere you don't fit, like you were saying, Baylor, and being surrounded by what you're going to be.
Yep.
Absolutely. It's also a reminder to Alex that her father does not define who she is as a person, right? She goes to Croatoa and meets Julia and Miss King, who are two very, very important people in Alex's life. And Julia is this bright, bubbly, happy-go-lucky person who, even though her father is Abraham Thorne, is still very much herself. I think it's a good reminder to Alex that even though her father is who he is, she can be her own person. She can have her own personality.
On top of that, though, I like that before she leaves, they go to that cotillion, and she just gets reminded multiple times of who her father is.
She does, yeah.
So it's almost like Croatoa is the free world, not worrying about Abraham, and then going back to Charmbridge, I'm a thorn.
Yeah. She is a thorn. I don't know. Do you guys think this is a good time for a 3-sentence summary, or should we toss that at the end?
Probably at the end, right?
Let's do that at the end. Let's do a discussion of our top 7 characters.
Perfect.
How's that sound?
Yeah.
We
mostly agreed.
Yeah, we've kind of taken a different strategy this time. We did not come to a sit-down and like a sit-down consensus of who our top 7 characters were this time. Instead, what we did was we ranked our 15 favorite characters and then created a top 10, a top 7, using the average ranking that we each gave each of the characters. And it led to a couple of changes. For the most part, we agree. We agreed, not in the order, but we agreed on who the top 4 were. Not specifically on the order of things, but who would fit into that top 4. And then from there, things got a little bit more scattered, but for the most part, we completely agreed. In fact, Baylor, you and I had the exact same top 7, not in terms of order, but who's included. Delbert, you had one difference from us, and we'll get to that discussion in a moment. But for the most part, we agreed. We agreed on, as a group, 8 of the top 10.
Well, it looks like, too, we actually agreed on the top 6. They were in different orders.
Oh, yeah, we did.
But 1 through 6, everyone has a vote 1 through 6.
We did. So, without further ado, I think we'll start with number 7 and work our way towards number 1.
Sure.
Our 7th most important character from Alexander Quick in The Lands Below, contested by you, Delbert, but agreed upon by Baylor and I, is the leader of the generous ones, Sayayaqui, we think.
Yeah.
Is this character's name.
It's the closest I'm going to get to pronouncing it.
I think we could just maybe give each one reason why we agree or disagree. Sayayaqui, for me, has to be in the top 7 because Sayayaqui is essentially the reason that Max died, or at the very least, the person who made the deal that caused Max's death.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he is really the reason. I mean, he was, if there was a major plot driver in the latter half of the book, that event was it, and it was caused by him. So, yep, I agree.
Delbert, you disagreed.
Slightly. So I had him ranked at 11 in my 15. To me, it's the generous ones as a whole, yes. But to me, it feels like if not him, it's just the next guy. So I don't think he himself is important. And I had people like Tomo and John Manuelito lower than him in my ranking, or like more important in my ranking, because they led to the plot rather than just being a device.
Sure. So would you agree that the position of the leader of the
Generous
Ones? Oh, absolutely.
If we had done it position of the Generous Ones or like Generous Ones as a whole, I think I would have been right alongside you guys.
Sure, that's fair. So number seven, most important character from this book for us is Sayekwi, the leader of the Generous Ones. Number six, a pleasant surprise, I think, for me, because I was wondering if you guys would agree, especially because this character was an honorable mention, I believe, in our last season finale.
Yes.
Charlie the Raven.
Yeah.
Coming in at number six. First of all, he is steadfast. Charlie is always present in Alex's life. He always presents the same sort of character. He's always available to her when he needs her. He also saved her life in this book, which he did in the first book too. This time, circumstances were a lot more dire, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, the first book to me felt a little bit slower than this book. And I think the difference was when this book started to slow down, Charlie stepped in and brought in that plot driver. You know, he brought in the Mors Morda Society coin. He found the obol, you know, that kind of stuff. So he's obviously a very important character for the story.
Same thing you guys said. Mors Morda coin, obol, bone flute, all of those through Charlie.
Those are all Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very important to this book. Charlie getting that sixth place finish, moving up in the world. We'll see if he can continue his climb after the next book. Coming in at number five, another new character to the story. Number five for us this time is Miss King, the lady of Croatoa, Miss King. Why did we put her at number five?
For me, it's real simple. She is the mother that Alex needs. I mean, Shirtliff is trying to be like a potential figure, I think, to keep her on the right path. Dean Grimm has had moments, but nothing has been more motherly and open and able to be talked to about important things than Miss King. She's been great. She's a steady rock for Alex. I hope she continues to be that role.
I also agree with that. Just to add to it, I think that she is the only one probably in the world that could understand Alex's position. And I say that because Julia, like you said, Brady, is kind of more of the happy-go-lucky person. These other three sisters seem to not really be involved with Abraham Thorne. And so really the only two people that are super involved and know about it are Miss King and Alex. And so I think she can connect with her on that deep of a level. And that's the only person she can do that with, especially now that Max is dead.
Yeah, I don't need to add anything else. You guys covered the whole gamut with Miss King. Very important for those reasons. Really a good person for Alex to have in her life.
Yep.
Coming in at number four, a new addition to our top seven as well. And the only person that we universally agreed on as far as their position order in this ranking, somebody we haven't talked about a lot so far today. We have mentioned her, though. Young Miss Darla Dearborn coming in at number four in our most important characters ranking. Hard to keep her out, to be honest. Very much a plot driver like Charlie was this book. Also, just a complete lunatic. Tried to kill Alex at one point in this book. I think cast the first AK we've seen in this story so far.
Alex tried to cast the second two chapters later.
Indeed. Got Alex access to the obol. Very important, even though it was unintentional.
Yeah.
I have a question, and this is a little bit derailing, so bear with me. We now know what the obol does. It takes you to the lands below. Why did Darla want an obol so bad?
Dude, good question.
Yeah, that's
I don't think
question.
We ever discussed that.
I mean,
that is still something we don't know the answer to.
It's along the lines of what was the weird connection between Darla and Alex the entire book, because that wasn't fleshed out either. You know, why did Darla try to kill Alex from the beginning?
We don't know. What I will say, Baylor, I guess, without spoilers or anything, is there's one hint in this book. One hint about what might be happening.
And it is obscure, because I barely noticed it on my third time through.
Indeed, and I can't give you more than that, unfortunately, because then I think it breaches into spoiler territory, but there's one thing that happened in this book that might open your eyes a touch. And when Delbert says he didn't catch it till his third time through, he's being serious. I didn't catch it till we read it for this podcast.
Yeah, I'm not even going to go look, to be honest.
No, it would be hard without the... It's hard with the evidence to see what we're talking about. And for all we know, could be unrelated. But there's a chance that that's what started everything, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that would be exciting to know. So yeah. I will await that day here in the next...
I think you'll know
years.
After book four, maybe?
Maybe after book four, yeah. So... 2 years from now.
Yeah.
Okay. Coming in at number three and beginning a family affair of sorts.
Spoilers.
Abraham Thorne.
True.
He's been knocked from his position at the top of our most important characters list from last book. A bit controversially so. Delbert, you had him at number one.
I did.
So I'll let you explain why we have him at number three.
Everything. Everything about these books is because of Abraham Thorne. The reason that Max is at Charmbridge, the reason that Alex meets her brother and finds out about the rest of her family, the reason they go to the lands below, the person that Alex is most curious about. This feels to me more like Abraham Thorne and his secret plots than Alexandra Quick and the lands below. And that Alex is basically a plot device for whatever Abraham's trying to accomplish.
I think everything you're saying is absolutely fair.
Yep.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. When you just said this feels more like a story called Abraham Thorne and his secret plots, you're correct.
Yeah.
It does feel like that.
The only reason I had him at three, because Brady and I both had him at three, was, I don't know Brady's reason, but my reason is because, well, we just don't know what the hell's going on with these secret plots. So that's why I put him at number three.
That's fair. If you got his book, it would just be like 900 pages of redacted text. So I can see why you wouldn't put him at number one.
Yeah.
Abraham Thorne. What a guy. Enemy number one of the podcast, maybe, right now. To be honest.
Yeah, he's up there.
I hate him much more than I hate Darla Dearborn, which she was enemy number one, I think, for a while.
Yeah.
I just like, I want to like the guy, but he hasn't given me a reason to like him. So, yeah.
I think right now my number one and two are Abraham and Richard Raspire.
Alan Thiel, excuse me.
Alan Thiel, hell yeah. My bad, forgot.
All right, so Abraham Thorne is our third most important character of this book. Coming in at number two, also a bit controversially, because you had him at number one, Baylor, and Delbert, you had him at number three, is Maximilian Thorne. I'll just go on the record saying that it goes without saying that he had to be a top three for most important. I think without question. I don't know how you could keep him out of the top three, even with his untimely, unfortunate death. For me, Max is the reason Alex grew up so much in this book. Because she finally had a guiding force to help her along that path, which is something I think we've been waiting for as readers, and also something Alex has been waiting for, whether she knew it or not, was somebody to help her, and Max became that person.
That's why I put him at number one. To go along with that, I mean, he introduced her to the other side of the wizarding world, you know, introduced her to dueling, introduced her to a whole new place in the Confederation. So, I mean, without Max, like you said, Brady, earlier, we probably wouldn't be reading book three because we would be so pissed off at Alex. So that's why I put him at number one.
really unfortunate that he's gone, but also we've discussed this in a former episode, or at least I've given my thoughts about this in a former episode. I do think his death was necessary. Yeah. Because while he was the guiding light, I feel like as long as he stuck around after the events of the Lands Below, he would have then become a crutch for Alex to not continue to grow on her own. So, unfortunate death, but very important character. He holds a place of very high esteem in our podcast by being named the number two most important character in Alexander Quick and the Lands Below.
For the record, that also played into why I put him as number one. I love plot drivers, and his death was definitely one of them.
Max, fair. The ultimate plot driver.
Yeah, that's what he'll be remembered for.
Before we reveal number one, which I'm sure everybody is currently anticipating with much wonder.
Yeah, no idea who it could be.
I thought we should talk about some honorable mentions. Before we do that, I want to note our biggest fall in rankings. All the way from number, I believe, 5 in our last season finale to number, what is that, 13?
13.
Anna Chu.
Unfortunate.
Biggest fall in our rankings, and we, I think, made clear our feelings about her in this book and how she wasn't that important. That being said, we do have some honorable mentions.
First, that was the dishonorable mention.
That was the dishonorable mention, yeah. first honorable mention goes to one, Diana Grimm. This one, a bit tough. We had to decide between Diana Grimm and Tomo Matsuzaka. And I think Baylor put it best in our group chat when he said, Tomo's the ultimate one-hit wonder. She could have been higher up, but I think you're right, Baylor. She disappeared after the first half of the book. She's just gone.
Yeah, yeah. I that's one of the questions, right? It's like, what part did that play in the story, other than maybe setting Anna off in this weird direction?
My reason, because I'm the one who ranked her higher, putting her in contention, is I liked that was Alex resolving a problem.
That was nice.
Which is not something we see very often.
Which,
that's fair.
Tomo also is the one who sort of introduces Mors Mortis a little bit, I think, to us. At least, maybe not introduces, but she's the one who can, I think, ultimately gets Alex out of Mors Mortis.
Gives her a reality check when she says, I'm only here because I'm terrified of you.
Equally important. So that's important. But our first honorable mention goes to Diana Grimm. She set herself up to play a very important character going forward.
I agree. I can get behind that.
Seems like she'll second honorable be mention. There.
Yeah,
that's true. She made what, 3 appearances at very different times
she
in
did.
The book.
Yeah.
Second honorable mention goes to Julia King. Tough one, I think, to keep out of the top 7 a little bit, but I think her impact on Alex's story is less plot driving and more moral support than anything else.
Well, I think, at the end of the book, we saw her kind of be the shoulder for Alex to cry on. And I said earlier, like, Miss King and Alex can obviously connect on the whole Aram Thorn side. But having a sister that's near her age, I think, is more on the girl-to-girl and growing up side, you know what I mean? So, like, she fills that other role that Miss King maybe necessarily doesn't.
She also, as the book ends, like you say, Baylor, is one of the only 3 humans in the entire book that knows what happened in the Lands Below.
It's true.
Indeed.
Her, Alex, and Abraham.
And our last honorable mention, again, I think someone you could argue to take over the 7th role in terms of most important is Quimley, the house elf. Very intriguing character, first of all. Secondly, it does a lot to help Alex escape from the Lands Below. And thirdly, returns Alex and Max's belongings to Alex in the Lands Above somehow, even though I could swear Quimley's not allowed to go to the Lands Above.
Yeah, there's something in there. But the reason I ranked him as highly as I did was actually because I think there's, like you say with Diana Grimm, I think there's something there moving forward. Because he feels some sort of attachment to Abraham Thorne. And that is something that's going to be explored, I would assume, over the next few books.
I would agree.
There's too much mystery behind why he's in the Lions below for him just to go away. You know what I mean? So, like, I think it'll definitely come up.
Yeah.
And with that being said, our number one most important character from a book titled Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below,
Angelique Devereaux,
is none other than Alexandra Quick, reclaiming, I would say, her rightful place at the top.
Right.
After she got second place.
Yeah, she got a one vote from you, two from me and Baylor, so it's a clear front runner. Like you said, the title says it all. We see everything through her perspective, and overall, on top of all that, like you said, Brady, great character growth, this book.
Great character growth. Lots of cool things. Very excited for her going forward.
Yeah.
All right. Those are our top seven most important characters. I'll run through them again really quick. At number seven, Seyeyaqui, leader of the Generous Ones. At number six, Charlie the Raven. Number five, Miss King. Number four, Darla Dearborn. Number three, Abraham Thorne. Number two, Maximilian Thorne. And number one, Alexandra Quick. I think it's a good list.
It is. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. So
moving on.
Before we move on, because we're running out of time, and I want to get this question in because it's been killing me since our last episode. When I was reading for the beloved audiobook snippet before the episode, I remembered all the way back from chapter 29 that Alex had requested from Abraham Thorne that if they succeed in the lands below, her and Max, that Abraham Thorne would owe her a boon. Obviously, it never came back up in this book. I just want to know what you guys' your thoughts are. Obviously, you know what happens in the next book. So if you don't want to spoil anything, you don't have to. Or if it's going to spoil anything, don't. But
all I'm going to say is Alex is not the type of person to forget.
I'd say that man has an outstanding boon on his head.
Yeah, she is not the type of person to forget.
That's exactly what I thought. And I figured it wasn't a oversight by Imberardi. I figured it was going to come up in this next book. Or maybe
yeah,
not
you'll
the next
definitely
book, so.
In the future see something about that.
Good.
Moving forward, we're going to do a couple things to wrap the book up. Because we are getting close to the end here. The first thing is we're going to rename the book. The book titled Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below is going to get a new name, beginning with you, Baylor.
Awesome. So my name might be a little bit long, but just stick with me. I decided to rename the book Alexandra Quick and the Unequivocal Pain That Her Father Leaves in His Wake.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
So...
sure. It definitely happens. He's an unfortunate person.
Yeah.
Mine is Alexandra Quick and the Year of the Flying Horse. Because I like the flying horses from Croatoa.
I was going to say, calling out that one scene.
alternatively, mine was going to be called Alexandra Quick and Adventures Beyond.
That's pretty good.
Not bad. Whew. Man, did not... I try to do these as we get to them.
Sure.
I don't try to prepare.
Yeah, no, we know.
But also, I'm going to break the entire segment here. The Year of Darkness.
You're just going to call it The Year of Darkness?
No Alexandra Quick in the title.
Nice.
That's fair.
It's not bad, actually.
A lot of darkness.
A lot of darkness in this one, for sure.
Yep.
For sure. So there you have it. Those are our new titles for Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. And now we're going to each have the honor of summarizing these books, or this book, rather, in three sentences. Our old favorite.
The traditional.
We're not going to create a summary together, though. We're going to each have three sentences on our own.
Right.
So, Baylor, would you like to start?
Sure. Mine's pretty simple. Alex meets a brother. Alex and her brother get to know each other. Alex loses a brother.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, okay is all right. To be honest, that was pretty good. I actually think that was pretty good. Mine is Alex discovers her best friend is a horrible racist. Then she joins an evil society full of wannabe dark wizards. Finally, she suffers tragedy like no 12/maybe 13-year-old girl should have to.
Nice.
That's a good summary. It's a bit more inclusive than mine.
Delbert.
Alex starts in a world that is unfit for her. She returns to a world and makes a better situation for herself. But unfortunately, that situation is shattered.
Okay. I see we all finished at least on the same note.
Yeah.
Of horrible tragedy and senseless death.
I wanted to start with just a small town girl living in a lonely world.
Sure.
She took the Charmbridge bus and became a little bit happier for some time.
So there you go. As always, three sentence summaries really, really produce for us.
Yeah.
Those ones I should probably do ahead of time. They're
possibly
tough. They're tough.
Yeah, we'll consider that for the next season.
Right. I'm all for going back.
Maybe the
three
sentence summary will come back. That's exactly right. Maybe
I thought
it
was great doing it on the spot. It's a lot better when you only have one sentence.
Maybe we'll do a three paragraph summary.
Oh Lord.
No, well, we don't even know what changes we're planning to make between this season and next season. We'll have to figure that out in the meantime. But it is that time. Baylor, for you to make one final prediction. And that one final prediction is, what is the next book going to be about? It's called Alexander Quick and the Deathly Regiment. You are allowed a couple of questions if you wish. And then you have to make a prediction talking about what the entire next book is going to be like.
Indeed. Did you want to begin with the prediction for this book and grade it?
Oh, I would love that, actually.
Yes.
I completely forgot.
I mean, it makes sense. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to read this because I don't have the audio recording, but Alex will return to Charmbridge for a second year. During the first part of the year, the two serpents, the Governor General and the Thorn Circle, that have been rearing their heads at each other behind the scenes for the 12 years that Alex has been alive, will come to bare their teeth in a more public way. Then Alex will travel to the lands below, previously stated as Death Valley in California, to confront her dad. Upon pledging her allegiance to him, they must figure out a way to bring down Governor General Huxtein and prove Thorne's innocence.
Hot damn. That was your prediction at the end of season one?
Indeed.
It started okay.
It did start okay and then derailed a touch. Alex certainly is not on her father's side at this moment, I would say.
Yep, definitely.
Now, you didn't even predict that she had a secret brother, so like...
Yeah, that's pretty sus.
I don't even know if it's fair to give this one a grade.
It's tough, right? Because how are you supposed to predict anything that happens in a book?
Just round it out. Round out the season with a... Just hurt my feelings. It'll be all right.
Four.
She did go to the lands below.
Uh-huh.
I would argue that Abraham Thorne does rear his teeth in a much more public way.
Yeah, he murders hundreds of people.
Yep. Because of the situation, I'm going to go with a 6.
You've convinced me. I'll go up to 5.5.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Pleasant.
It is a tough thing to make a prediction about the entire plot of a book you've never read.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's horribly, horribly difficult. So you wanted me to ask some questions for this upcoming book.
If you have a couple, that would be great.
I do.
Keeping in mind, our studio time is swiftly running out.
Right. Yes, I will be quick. Brady, does Abraham Thorne remain in the shadows, similar to book 2 in book 3?
Yes. Unfortunately, Abraham Thorne is a shadowy little boy.
Yeah, that sounds like him. Sounds like I'll also be pissed off at the end of that book. Anyways, Delbert, does the title The Deathly Regiment refer to the Confederation's military or J-Rock in any way?
No.
All right, let me think of this prediction. All right, for my prediction for this upcoming book, Alex will return to Charmbridge to complete her third year of wizard schooling. Everyone will know now of Max's death from the year previous, and the rumors will be a-flyin'. Things will be relatively mundane until about Halloween, when another established group of the Dark Dimension, the Deathly Regiment, will come into the public eye. This group, mostly made up of old Death Eaters that escaped persecution from the Ministry in the UK, will begin to play the game that the Thorn Circle and the Confederation have enjoyed alone thus far. Alex, conflicted between helping her father or helping the Confederation, will lead to an indecisiveness that will ultimately get her captured by the Deathly Regiment. The latter part of the book will detail her escape from them.
Hopefully, first of all,
hopefully a banger.
I hope you're right, because damn, does that sound awesome.
Yeah.
Great prediction. I think excellent prediction. I'm not saying excellent in terms of whether it's correct or not, but excellent prediction in terms of what kind of story value that would add.
Right. I agree.
That would be
hilarious.
It does
make me wonder, when are we going to stop with the Death Eaters making their way to
yeah,
America?
Yeah.
Perhaps never, when it gets proven correct in the next book.
That would be so awesome. Okay.
I'll just give Baylor an A for the whole book, if that happens, because of his comments from book one.
Sure.
Yeah.
He's been playing the long con.
Yeah, next thing we know is the Daily Prophet is going to have that Lilith writer from the very first chapter.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, listener, you can come find out what happens next year on the Remedial Magic Podcast.
Exactly.
True.
We're taking an extended break. We're thinking at least 2 months.
Yeah.
Hopefully to allow us to come up with a better recording schedule. And also, it's time to take a little bit of a break away from this and pursue some other things for a couple of months. But we'll see you sometime.
Yeah. Keep reading Alex Quick if you haven't already. Check out Bagsy Beetlehorn. Check out Nightmares of Futures Past.
Yeah.
Just go on the fanfiction subs and check stuff out.
Yeah.
With that being said, a lot of thanks to the University of Wyoming Recording Studio. A lot of thanks to Inverarity for providing the source material. And a lot of thanks to us for providing you with quality content.
You're welcome.
During this season of the Remedial Magic Podcast.
True. In season three, I'm going to bring a badge that just says talent on it every time I record.
Whatever makes you
with
feel
better,
man.
With that being said, I've been Brady.
I've been Delbert.
I've been Baylor.
And we will see you sometime in the future.
Woo!
Good night.
Happy holidays.